Dan was diagnosed with diabetes in 1996 at the age of 10. He was also diagnosed with chronic kidney disease in 2018 and received a kidney transplant. I'll be really looking forward to hearing about Dan's experiences and stories this evening. Dan is a fantastic advocate for diabetes and is just truly inspirational in his sharing of his stories and his journey. Dan has worked for JDRF UK, and he may talk a little bit about that this evening and how working in such a safe and welcoming environment was supportive to him in his journey with diabetes. Dan also hosts the award-winning, amazing Type 1 Diabetes podcast, Talking Type 1, where Dan talks to people in the community from all over the world, sharing their personal journeys of life with type 1 diabetes. So welcome along, Dan Newman.
Thank you. Hi everyone, and thank you for the great introduction. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Dan. It's nice to see you, buddy. It's nice to have you on this evening, and it was great meeting you at TAD and having you on tonight. It's such an honor, and I think there's been a buzz in the air with people excited to listen to you chat this evening. And if anyone has any questions this evening, please get involved. You can hashtag diabetes chat and you can ask questions or any comments to what we're discussing, or you can ask to speak and you can ask Dan some questions. So really looking forward to it. Morgan's here, Chris is here, Dan. We'll ask some questions, we'll have a good chat, and like I said, if anyone wants to come forward, please do. So I thought, I've seen this on the internet, and I thought maybe a 1 minute quick fire round of questions. So I'll say some questions and you can just fire them out, some answers, and then we'll get into the sort of lengthier interview. And I thought this might be a nice little feature that we potentially do in the future with other guest speakers and maybe with the community as well, if you're up for it, if you want to play a little game.
Yeah, sounds good.
Brilliant, brilliant. So what's your name?
Daniel Newman. Do you want my middle name?
Occupation? No, it's okay. Occupation?
HR manager.
Age of diagnosed?
10.
Year?
1996.
Favorite hypo treatment?
Ooh. Can I have two?
You can have two, yeah.
Right, jelly babies.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say a carton of orange juice box.
Nice. Do you use insulin pens or pump?
I'm on the pump.
Do you finger prick or CGM?
Well, Libre, so flash.
There we go. What's worse, feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
I'd say feeling hypo.
Interesting. Are you hypo aware?
Yes.
What three symptoms, if you have three, do you have of hypos?
Shakes, not being able to formulate sentences properly,
Oh yeah, I know that one.
and then sometimes just feeling dizzy.
And when you finger pricked, did you change your lancet every day?
No.
Does anyone ever do that? One thing you like about your diabetes?
In a weird way, where it's got me to today. Yeah. The kind of
Brilliant.
life journey I've been on. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you not like about your diabetes?
The
Tough questions, aren't
relentlessness of it.
Yeah, definitely. Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
I love the smell of insulin.
Oh, wow. We're going to have to put that in a poll. And if you're on a desert island, what three things would you take on the desert island? Could be diabetes related or anything you want.
Probably going to sound a bit boring here, but insulin, obviously to stay alive, my phone,
Yeah.
and probably a football, just
No
something to
football.
keep me
Why
entertained.
not? You could be on Twitter doing videos of keepy uppies on the beach while eating some food and giving yourself an insulin shot. That's all you need, eh? To survive.
Exactly.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you, Dan. That was amazing. Thank you
All
so
right.
much.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed that, guys. And there we go. So welcome along, Dan. It's been amazing having you come on. And it's just such an honor meeting you a couple of weeks ago and to have you today. It's just fantastic. So what we're going to do is myself, Morgan, Chris got some questions. We're going to talk about your sort of background to diabetes, where it all began. We'll talk a little bit about diabetes wilderness, and then we'll talk about complications and when you were diagnosed with your chronic kidney disease and your transplant. And then we'll talk a little bit about sort of diabetes advocacy, peer support, and your amazing podcast. So we're going to head over to the States, and Morgan's going to check in with you with your background to your diabetes, where it all began.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Morgan. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. And thanks again for coming on and talking with us.
No, it's fine. Thank you for inviting me. So yeah, all good.
Yeah, so I guess we're going to start with kind of like your type 1 journey. So we know you were diagnosed at 10. Do you remember your diagnosis, like the symptoms you had, the like the feelings you had when you were diagnosed and all that?
So all I really remember from my diagnosis is so I was diagnosed in August, and so it was the summer holidays. I was off from school, and I was just drinking a lot. I was at my nan's house, and in the UK we have a drink called, you might even have it in the US, called Ribena. And so I was just drinking that a lot, and that's all I remember. And then I was unwell in the evening, and then my mum called the emergency GP, so primary practitioner, and said you need to take him to accident and emergency, so the emergency room now. And then I was there for hours, and they said you've got diabetes, and that was it, really. But obviously, being 10, you don't really understand what's happening. You just know it's serious because you're at the hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in that time, how long from when you got diagnosed, in between, like you said it was August, so school started fairly soon after that, am I right?
Yeah, so it was the 17th of August that I was diagnosed, and then school probably started definitely the first week of September.
So do you remember what that was like, going back into school and like the change from the year before to that year?
Yeah, definitely. So in the UK, for people based in the UK, I had left year five and I was going into year six. So it's the last year of primary school before you go to secondary school. And when I look back, I realized I was just different to everyone else. So if I was having a hypo, I would have to, Lucozade was the hypo treatment back then. So it was kept in a cupboard in the classroom. And then I'd have to go to the cupboard and drink my Lucozade. And there were all these different changes where none of my other friends were doing the same things that I had to do. But because I was in a relatively small school, and I was in the oldest age group there, it wasn't as bad, because everyone kind of knew each other, everyone knew me. So it was okay. Although I did feel a bit different. I think my main challenges came when I moved from primary school to secondary school. So maybe high school.
Yeah. That sounds like it. I was diagnosed as a teenager, so it was a lot of feeling like kind of isolated. And did you ever, like, what were your, I guess, did you have any feelings of that? Were there any other type ones at your school?
No, definitely not at primary school. And when I moved to secondary school, I think there might have been one or two, but nobody in my year group, I think they were both older than me. I definitely didn't feel isolated in my younger years. It was as I went through my teenage years, and just being a teenager, even without a chronic illness, and you're trying to fit in, those years were the years where I just felt different to everyone, and felt really isolated then.
Yeah, it's like stuff you don't, I guess, really notice as like a kid, you know, under the age of 11 or 12. And then right when you hit those teenage years, you start to notice more things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. You've hit the nail on the head there.
So as you were like growing up, you were diagnosed in 96. So you've seen like a lot of the changes in management. So what did you use during those like adolescent years, like from when you were diagnosed until I guess fairly recently?
Yeah. So when I was first diagnosed, I can't remember the name of the sticks, but all I remember is that you could only get, I think the numbers were 3, 7, 9, 13, 15, 17, or it was on the side of the tube, and you would have to put your blood on the stick and then match up the color on the sticks to the colors on the side of the tube. And then not too long after that, I had a monitor, but then using the monitor, it wasn't as quick as the monitors nowadays. So again, that took time. And I think once I went onto the monitor, I've been using the monitor for a number of years, until probably maybe, I think, 3-4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago now. I started to use a Libra, and I've been using that ever since.
How do you like it? How do you like the Libra?
Yeah, I really like it. It's helped me a lot in terms of, obviously, my fingertips aren't as hard as they used to be, and just having to swipe takes a lot away from just the management and not having to think of having to prick my fingers and do all of that. However, I do think that I'm in a better frame of mind to use it now. And by that, I mean, I think maybe if I had this technology years ago, I might have obsessed a bit more about the numbers and swiping and that side of things. And then also, I really appreciate the alarms, because it gives me a sense of security, particularly at night, if I'm going hypo, it's made a big difference there. But again, if I look back, maybe I might not have utilized the technology as well as I am doing now, considering where my mind was when it came to managing diabetes. But I think technology is great. I think obviously we all need to be mindful of like technology burnout, and just making sure that we're using it, knowing when we are kind of going over, crossing that line for us. And I think it's different for everyone else, but there are times when it's okay to not consistently just be checking just to see what something's doing every single minute. You have to obviously allow your insulin to work, etc., if that has made any sense.
No, yeah, it has. It's like when you have CGMs like that, and you know you're running high, and then you take your insulin and it's not going down, and you're getting really frustrated, but you have to give it time to work. And I feel like I agree with you, a lot of times with technology, while it's like really, really good and we've gotten really far in management and it's helped so many people, it is very easy to become obsessive and make it an like unhealthy part of your mindset. Yeah, I know I always feel like super guilty when I see like high numbers and they don't go down for a long time, and it just makes me feel even like worse. And it's a notification like every 5 minutes from my Dexcom, and I'm like, I get it, chill out, I already know.
I agree with you there. And I think a key point is where you talk about emotion. So that's something that I struggled with for a number of years. And this is where I talk about the technology. So I would always attach emotion to the numbers that I would see on the meter. And that would mean I'm good, I'm bad. And eventually that was just a bit too much for me. So, you're totally right about the emotion that we can attach to to numbers and the data that we're given.
Yeah, it's like we already have to worry about all these numbers, and then we're putting our worth onto them as well, not just our blood sugars. So I totally get that. Are you currently on, like, are you still using MDIs, or are you on, like, a pump now?
Oh, no, so I'm on the pump, so I use an Omnipod, so.
Ah, I'm on an Omnipod, too. How do you like it?
I like it. So, this is my second insulin pump. I used the AccuCheck Insight before for 4 years, and I liked that because, for me, it was... Because I was going on to an insulin pump, I wanted something that was like pretty straightforward for me to understand. And I was already familiar with kind of Roche products. So I was like, this works for me. But the tubing did, I wouldn't say annoy me, but it did get on my nerves sometimes. But whereas I find with the Omnipod, it's the perfect balance between being on MDI and having an insulin pump, and I'm just be completely honest, it stops me from falling into bad habits. So when I was on the AccuCheck Insight, I wouldn't always change the cannula after 3 days, because it's not like the Omnipod where you have to change it every 3 days. And so, yeah, I would fall into bad habits with the cannula, which isn't good. And I'd recognize that. And the plus point for me with the Omnipod is that it just doesn't allow me to do that. And if anyone is using an Omnipod, you know, you hear that noise. Yeah, so there's no way that you can get around it. So, it's been really helpful for me. I think with technology, it's weird with diabetes tech, is that it's still technology. So sometimes it does and it will go wrong, as all technology does. But it's a bit weird because obviously there are consequences for to us when it does go wrong. But yeah, I really like the Omnipod. It's a nice balance for me. Being able to rotate it on different parts of my body is the definite benefit for me. So I personally like it.
Yeah. Pros and cons to every single pump. But yeah, sorry, lost my place in my notes here. So overall, like, I guess what have been like the ups and downs moments, and like what have been your biggest challenges so far since being diagnosed? Like any moments that kind of stick out?
Yeah, so I can probably picture more down moments, but the up moments have counteracted those down moments. So I think the down moments, particularly my teenage years, just that whole struggle with just trying to be a teenager, trying to fit in, wanting to just be normal, quote unquote normal, like everyone. That was definitely a down moment, and kind of reaching the point where I'd reached diabetes distress and diabetes burnout during those teenage years, and just saying to myself, oh, if you take insulin, you'll stay alive. So that's all you need to do. So I didn't do any testing or anything like that. And I look back and that's a real down moment. But then I think an up moment which kind of counteracts that is when I finally accepted that I had type 1. And that really changed everything for me. Down moments, I would say, being diagnosed with chronic kidney disease, and then being diagnosed with diabetic retinopathy, and those were down moments, because at that point it just kind of brought home the years where I hadn't managed my type 1 as well as I could have, even though I was doing the best that I could at the time. But I look back and maybe I could have done better. But also I think when you've when you do get diagnosed with a complication, you can feel like you failed a test. And I felt like I'd failed a test. I felt like I was a failure. I felt alone. But then the upside of that is where I am today and being able to look back and just being in a better place mentally and accepting what has happened. I mentioned in my talk at TAD, one of the upsides for me again was having the opportunity to work at JDRF in the UK, because where that came in, that kind of point that came in my life was where I was coming out of the back end of burnout, but still not really engaged with managing my type one. But then I was put into an environment where everyone kind of knew type one, and it was just a safe environment for me to be in. And I was able to be myself. I'd worked in workplaces previously where my type one was used against me. And so being in this environment was so different, and just having access to information that I'd never heard of before, again, was just that, as mentioned at TAD, it was life-changing for me. So yeah, there's been those real downsides, but the upsides have been, yeah, just they've been so high that they've helped me so much. And so yeah.
Wow, thank you so much for sharing all of that. Yeah, that was amazing. I'm gonna pass it on to Tom for the next section, but once again, thank you so much for talking to us about your journey. And I'm glad I got to talk to you.
No, that's okay, fine. It's a bit weird. I'm used to asking the questions, not not being asked the questions.
It's strange that the table's turning, but we're loving hearing your story.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Dan. That's really good, mate. And I think it really leads us on to our next session, talking about sort of diabetes wilderness. What is diabetes wilderness?
So I'm pretty sure it's something that I think I've made up. if I can remember the term. So it was basically a point of time where I was just disengaged from my healthcare team, healthcare professionals, and I was just doing diabetes and life without the specialist knowledge or information that I needed. And also what happens is when you're kind of out there are all of these changes that are taking place within the diabetes world, but because you don't have that connection, you have no idea of what's going on. So in a way, it's a bit like running on a treadmill where you're still in the same place, but you might be moving forward. Technically you are running and moving forward, but you're actually not, you're just in the same place. And I think, say, for example, the changes in technology over the past 2-3 years, had you not had a connection with the diabetes world, you'd be none the wiser of what's happened. And so yeah, it's just a place where you're on your own, you're doing diabetes, you're not engaged with anyone, you're not using the most relevant information that you might need to, you're not aware of anything that's going on, you're not adapting the way that you manage your type one to where you are in life. So
definitely.
The wilderness.
Yeah, I love it. So obviously you talked about, you obviously diagnosed at 10. It was in the summer before going back to school. I can imagine that was just a crazy experience on itself. Most kids are enjoying their summer holidays. They're going back and they're showing their kids the fake tattoos that they've had on the holidays. And there's you going, hey, I'm type 1 diabetic now. Obviously, you talked about the sort of emotional burden and the sort of diabetes stress and burnout. When would you kind of say that was significant in your life? When did you kind of have that feeling? Obviously with type 1 diabetes, it's commonly classed as like a physical condition, but obviously we all are very aware of the emotional feelings and burdens attached to it. So when could you maybe describe your experiences of diabetes stress and burnout and your experiences a bit more in detail with diabetes wellness. When did it kind of change in your life from someone who was diagnosed at 10, and then when did it kind of go off the track slightly?
Yeah, sure. So I would say probably 14, 15. And so partly I would say that when I've shared this on episodes of my podcast before. So when it came to managing type 1 and the environment that I grew up in, kind of particularly my family environment, a lot of it I was left to my own devices when it came to managing type 1, as well as everything else that was going on. And so that's the time that I can really remember where it just felt like it was just too much, just with everything that was going on. And as I've touched on before, the logic at that age was, you know, if you just take insulin, what do I need to stay alive? If you just take insulin, you'll be fine. I think also as well, at that point, you've been to numerous hospital appointments and you've heard, oh, you need to do this. And if you don't do this, then X is going to happen, then Y will happen. And as a teenager, you don't really want to hear that. You're not listening to what's being said. And 25, 30 seems so far away. And now when I look back in my mid-30s, I'm like, that time has just flown by. And so, yeah, it was really that point where it got to it. That was the beginning. And then it was just not wanting to talk about type 1 to anyone, none of my friends. It was very much on a need to know basis, and hardly anyone needed to know. And so, and as I go through the rest of my teenage years and going into the later teens and early 20s, again, it was just about wanting to fit in. So going out and just drinking, and like all my friends were doing, going out drinking, getting drunk, doing that on a Thursday night, maybe Friday night, Saturday night, just to fit in. And again, that was the point of just not caring about diabetes. And I would say that's I've never reached that point again. That was definitely the lowest point. But as I've touched on, I think some of the other low points have been around complications, particularly when I had got that initial diagnosis or an awareness that something was wrong. And it's not so much that not managing diabetes, but having that frustration there. You always look back and you sometimes think, oh, what if I did this and what if I did that? But again, it's that sort of mentality of what if is something I've had to navigate through, and that's taken a lot of time to navigate through the what if I did this and what if I did that. And so it's a lot easier for me to talk about it now and sound like, oh, I just got through it, when it wasn't like that at all. It took a long time to move away from that what if.
Absolutely. And I think you just hit in the nail on the head. And when I went to TAD talk, and there's a few listeners tuned in who went, I know Mo was there, it was so relatable. It was just pure inspirational, and I was just nodding the entire time. And I'm doing the same now. It's like, I remember when I was going through exactly the same thing as a teenager. You want to live life, you want to do things normal. And then I went to uni and I wanted to do things normal there. I wanted to go out, like you say, a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, and the rest of the week, of course. And you wanted to live life. And I can definitely relate to what you're saying in terms of, what do I need to do to survive? I was told I need to take the insulin, so I do that. And in my early years, I was told take 18 units for Lavimir or whatever, and take your set of dosages for lunch, breakfast. I did that. And over time, like you say, you reduced the amount of times you may check your levels and whatever. But yeah, definitely very, very relatable. So Have you ever sort of hidden your diabetes from anyone, friends, family, work colleagues? In terms of like in the early days or even now, like how did you find like injecting in front of other people in the same room, or would you go somewhere else? And I know you said you didn't really talk about it too much, especially with your family. So yeah, how could you just talk a little bit about that?
I definitely have. There was, where I didn't talk about it, I would hide it. I had a group of friends where they knew I had diabetes, and the extent of what they knew is if I was having a hypo and for some reason I didn't have hypo treatment, I would say, oh, I need sugar, and that was it. And it's funny because one of my friends, we've known each other. We met on the first day of secondary school, and we're still friends now. And he said to me not too long ago, he was like, it's weird that you talk about type 1 now as much as you do, because all you said to me back in school one day was, I need to be careful because it can affect my feet. And he was like, that's all you said to me. And so it, again, as I mentioned, it was like on a need to know basis. And so I've hidden it from my friends. At work, when I first started working part-time, I didn't tell anyone I had type 1, because it was in retail, it wasn't too bad in my mind anyway, because I was like, you can always go to the staff room and get hypo treatment if you need it.
Can I ask why did you hide it away? What made you go inject somewhere else or go about your business? Why would you not tell people?
I just hadn't accepted that I had type 1. So
Yeah.
for me, because the acceptance wasn't there, I couldn't then talk to people about it. And I didn't want to speak to people about it as well. I think I didn't want people to ask me questions because then I'd have to answer questions. If I just didn't talk about it, no one would know I was living with type 1, because no one would ever know. And going to the toilet to do injections, that was fine. Again, another way to hide it. No one would ever know. And so I d didn't tell anyone there. When I started to work full time, after leaving uni, I would tell at least one person on my team, just so that at least somebody was aware in the workplace what was going on. But yeah, it was just the but I would never inject in public. That came a lot later.
Yeah, and how do you find it now? Obviously, you're on the pub now, but what sort of got you to that level of acceptance to go, ah, okay, this is how I feel. I'm feeling better about myself. Is there a moment that you got to, or like, can you describe that moment?
It got to the point of just a bit before, I would say, as I mentioned in my talk at TAD, that my girlfriend at the time, who became my wife, and although we're no longer together, I think having her a lot on at my side when it came to managing type 1, that started to make a change, and started, I thought, oh, okay, this is okay. And then again, it was just the working at JDRF, and I think I might have just seen a colleague do an injection at their desk, and for me that was just that
Huge.
eye-opening, and feeling like, oh, I can do that. And
Yeah.
having me doing an injection wasn't weird to anyone. I wasn't abnormal or just anything. It was just like, oh, okay, well, Daniel's got type 1, okay, that's fine. And then it kind of progressed from there, but it was just all on my own terms, and it would always be just small things. So like, yeah, I would inject at my desk, or I'd test my levels at my desk. Gradually over time, I then would maybe inject in front of people, or if I was out in public. And so yeah, it was a gradual build up, but I think those two key things just changed a lot for me. And then it got to the point where I know Mary's in the chat. I don't know if Mary's been to one, but at JDRF there's a type 1 diabetes awareness training course, so all new members of staff have to go through that training. And there's usually a section in there where colleagues who have lived experience of type 1, whether you live with type 1 or you're a parent of a child with type 1, you'll come in and you'll talk about your experience. And there's been a few occasions where I've done a site change with both my Omnipod and when I was on the AccuCheck Insight as well, just so people could really understand like what happens when with somebody living with type 1. And so 15 years of thought that I would do that at any point. Full circle in a way.
Yeah, definitely. Just rewinding a little bit, in terms of acceptance and how you're feeling through them sort of teenage years, what were your thoughts on like social stigmas and stuff, and was that one of the influences of maybe how you felt, and maybe how you felt in terms of maybe not being as open as maybe what you wanted to be with your diabetes? Did that impact on you?
I look back and I don't think social stigmas impacted me as much as maybe. I think for me it was more to do with culture. So I'm from a Caribbean background, and within a culture we don't really talk about health as much as we should. That's definitely changed over the years, and it's great to see. But I think back then nobody really spoke about health, so because no one spoke about health, I wasn't really going to speak about health as well. So it wasn't really so much a social stigma. I think culture had a part to play in me not talking about it, more so than any social stigma.
Definitely.
When I say social stigma, I'm talking about wider society rather than culturally.
Yeah, definitely. And I liked how you touched upon like that turning point in your life where you had the support of your girlfriend, and then obviously went on to be your wife, and that value of other people supporting you and having your back. And I think that was great. And also you talked a little bit about your JDRF experience, and already you've mentioned about being in that sort of safe environment with other people who are in the same boat as you, and being around with them and seeing that person inject, and wow, you know what I mean? It's real, it's meaningful. And it's just great. And when I attended TAD, being in that sort of environment with other people, it felt incredible. Just having someone there who's going through the exact same thing. Before we head over to Chris, what have you sort of learned from your experience in terms of your wilderness, and what advice and tips would you maybe give people of all ages, of backgrounds, and maybe a bit relatable to what you went through in terms of you as a young person and kind of transitioning from pediatric to adult clinics, and what sort of advice and tips would you give people who maybe are feeling a bit alone or in their sort of own wilderness journey?
I think firstly, my first piece of advice was just to, I know again this might sound a bit cliche, but just acknowledge how you're feeling, and it's okay to feel isolated, it's okay to feel alone, it's okay to feel overwhelmed by diabetes type 1. It is okay to feel that way. Diabetes has a funny way of making you feel like you're a failure, when actually you're not. You're doing your best, and you're doing the work of an organ in your body, which is a lot. And I would say reach out and get some help, whether it be with your healthcare team, whether it be, obviously you have to be careful with in terms of who you interact with on social media, but whether it be if you're on Twitter, and this is focused on the GB doc, but whether it be reaching out to the GB doc account and just saying, there are so many different points where you can reach out. Even if you want to know that you're just not alone and you don't want your friends and family to know the accounts you follow, even if you just create another Twitter profile and you just follow diabetes accounts on that, and you don't have a profile picture, but it's just for you and you just know that you're not alone. There's so many different ways that you can, that you, I would say, to kind of just reach out and trying to get the help and support from others. I think with the wilderness, it, again, I've probably touched on it, it is okay to acknowledge that you do have these feelings, and but also just to remember as well that you can overcome where you are, and you do have the opportunity to change your current circumstances with where you are with type 1. I'm not saying that if you've been in the wilderness for a long time like I have, I'm not saying that any damage that has been done is just gonna go with a click of the fingers. There may be something that you have to acknowledge and work through at a later date, but also the fact that you got to where you are rather than where you were before is a huge thing. So hopefully that's the main thing, is just I don't want anyone to feel that where they are now, if they're not feeling great when it comes to managing type 1, is that's where you're going to stay forever, because I don't believe that's the case. I do think, whether I sound overly positive, I don't know, but I just do think that you have the opportunity to change. I'm not saying it's easy. It can be difficult, and it is. But at the same time, you can do it, and just celebrate the small wins as well, even if it's testing once a day. From going from not testing at all to once a day, that's a win.
Yeah, definitely, Dan. That was just amazing, mate. Everything you just said was incredible, and I think just reaching out to whoever you can in whatever capacity, please just do it and spread that out, isn't it? Like you say, setting up a sort of side account or whatever way you feel you can do to reach out, it's so important. Thank you so much. What we're gonna do is gonna head over back to Chris in the States, and he's gonna head up the next section. And if anyone wants to get involved, you can hashtag diabetes chat, and you can let us know what you're thinking of the chat so far. If there's any sort of responses to what Dan has been saying, or if you've got any questions for Dan, please do that. Or you can press that blue button at the bottom of the screen and it instantly opens it up for you. So you can send a message or you can request to speak, and we can get you on to ask Dan any questions. But yeah, appreciate your thoughts, and we can relay that back to Dan. Over to you, Chris.
All right. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you. I'm good.
I think they always give me the hard topics when they're planning out who's going to ask which questions. I should probably preface all of this just with a sort of PSA, and that is that I want to let everybody know that if you do have complications from diabetes, whether it's been, you know, you've only had diabetes a year, or you've had diabetes for 30 years or 50 years or 70 years, it's not your fault. I think that's something that frequently gets lost. And it frustrates me, because I see all these people, they're doing everything they possibly can. They're following their physicians and specialists instructions to the letter, and it still happens. And I think it's important to highlight that there are people without diabetes who get diabetes complications. It's rare, but it does happen. So just the fact that someone has experienced a complication isn't something that should be, you know, judged. But just having gotten that out of the way, since you've had some experience with this, what are sort of the common long-term complications of diabetes that we think of? Can you sort of share your knowledge in brief summary of what are the big things that people should be watching out for and getting checked?
Oh, in terms of the complications,
right?
Oh yeah. So in terms of, well, for me, talking from my experience, obviously when it comes to your eyes, the kidneys, obviously there's neuropathy as well. And then I think those are kind of the main ones that are spoken about, but then we can obviously expand that to where we're talking about, eating disorders and disordered eating. So yeah, I'm not quite sure if I've answered your question well enough. But yeah.
If we just sort of run down the list, I mean, we've obviously got your eyes with the retinopathy, nerves with neuropathy, diabetic kidney disease, hand in hand with the neuropathy goes with circulation problems, especially in the extremities.
And your, yeah.
In the feet, and then also sort of getting up to the really high level stuff, the increased risk for cardiovascular events, heart attacks and strokes, which obviously those are beyond even the what we sort of traditionally think as complications.
Yeah, you answered that a lot better than I did, so thank you. Thanks, Chris.
can you think of anything I missed?
I think you covered it all, but if there is something missed, maybe somebody can jump in and let us know.
Okay. But sort of getting into the things that you have definite firsthand knowledge of, can you sort of give us an overview of the potential kidney complications that can occur? What they call diabetic chronic kidney disease?
Yeah. So for me, as mentioned, I was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease. So interestingly, it wasn't called diabetic chronic kidney disease. It was just called chronic kidney disease. And I think that had a huge part to play in my overall kind of acceptance of kidney disease and it not solely having kind of the diabetic label added to it. But I can talk about that a bit more. So it was the chronic kidney disease. But in the lead up to actually being diagnosed with chronic kidney disease, my kidneys were leaking. So there was protein in my urine. So in the lead up to that, I was having to take tablets to protect my kidneys. But it eventually developed to chronic kidney disease. And then when it came to, so I live with diabetic retinopathy. And so when it came to that, my experience was I did attend eye appointments, but when I was, as I've mentioned, in the wilderness, I didn't attend eye appointments. And things kind of came to a head. I woke up one day and I had a floater in my eye. And that really panicked me. And then once that happened, then I went to the emergency eye clinic and had to get that sorted or checked out, which then led down to me having to have laser surgery, etc.
I was going to ask if they lasered it for you.
Yes, they did. But then even after that, so I've had multiple laser surgeries in both my eyes. I've had bleeds in my eyes, I've had vitrectomy surgery in my right eye. I think that was just over 2 years ago now. So that kind of getting to that point, it all started from when I had the first floater, and kind of going from there.
What was the sort of progression with the kidneys? Did you, had it been something that they were sort of keeping an eye on for a while? At one point they did a urinalysis and noticed that there was some protein spilling into the urine and sort of flagged it to keep an eye on it, or and what was that sort of progression like?
Yes, yeah, it was exactly that. That's why I can't remember when it was first identified. I just remember the actual the diagnosis of the chronic kidney disease being 2013. So yeah, it was exactly like that it was identified, and then just gradually over time it got worse. And just during that whole period up until, or maybe I'm jumping ahead, but just up until the point of transplantation, it was just the monitoring my kidney function. And one big change which happened during that period is I was given medication, and at that same point I was given the medication, my 3 months after that my function dropped from 60% to 40%, and that was the only change that had happened in terms of what I was doing. And I was speaking to the nephrologist about that, and that drop kind of, it felt like it almost subconsciously felt like it just felt like the beginning of the end, because it had my EGFR had been very consistent at 60% for a longer period of time, and then when it dropped, it felt like there was no way it was going to come back up, and then subsequently it continued to fall.
Did you wind up on dialysis as an intermediate thing before the transplant, or was it straight from walking around to the operating table?
Yeah, so I am very, 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 very fortunate that for me it was, I didn't need and I haven't had dialysis. So my function dropped to, I think, around 4 or 5%. That was about a couple of days before the transplant. And I didn't need dialysis. So I was very fortunate in that sense to, as you quite rightly say, go from walking around to just going into having the transplant, which doesn't happen for many people. So yeah, I'm just very, very fortunate in that aspect of being able to just go to straight to transplantation.
This is sort of a curiosity thing, since we've actually had Dr. Senior on earlier, who was in charge of doing islet cell transplants. Did they consider trying to do an islet cell transplant or a pancreas in addition to the kidneys to try to address the diabetes as well? Or was it just that was not on the table?
Oh, no, so that was on the table. But for me, so for two reasons why I didn't want to go down that route. One, this may not make sense to people listening, but in my mind, the issue was with my kidneys. So I was just like, if the issue is with the kidneys, let's sort out the kidneys. Because I did also think, if I have the pancreas and kidney transplant, yes, I won't have type 1 for a period of time, but it will come back at some point. And I felt mentally in a place where I could have the kidney transplant and manage type 1. Also, as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to my ethnicity, so I'm from, as mentioned, from the Caribbean, African Caribbean background, there's a much longer wait for an organ donor when you're from an African Caribbean background in the UK. So that also had a part to play as well in my decision. There's quite a bit going on in terms of what led me to my final decision than just having the kidney transplant.
I assume you're continuing to be on immunosuppression and stuff as a transplant recipient, are there sort of any other day-to-day things that you do to help manage having been a transplant recipient now?
Yeah, so you're right in terms of the immunosuppression drugs and anti-rejection drugs. And with the transplanted kidney, for me, it's about just making sure that I stay hydrated. One of the things that I'm very conscious of, particularly going through the chronic kidney disease journey, is just the amount of salt that I'm taking in as well. Just being much more aware of that than I was before. Obviously, trying to do regular exercise as well. And what the surgeons have always said to me is it's always about looking after your kidney as well as you can. So that's always stuck with me, and something that I try to do as much as I can.
When you were diagnosed, I assume that they probably, you know, harangued you with all manner of horrible things that could happen as far as complications and stuff. Do you think that affected your outlook on this? Do you think that those sort of tactics are effective for some patients, or do you think it leads to a sort of fatalism where people might not necessarily take the best care of themselves because they're thinking all of this is inevitable?
Are you talking about when I was diagnosed with type 1, you mean?
Yeah.
So scare tactics don't work, and they will never work. I've seen this conversation so much across the community that they don't work, and it's not the right way, and it will never be the right way to motivate someone, particularly just the whole nature of type 1 diabetes. And as you mentioned as well, which I really liked before you started asking the question, was about people can develop, you said diabetes complications, but what I liked about that, and just going back to what I said when it comes to chronic kidney disease, is that it wasn't diabetic chronic kidney disease, it was chronic kidney disease. So as much as it was type 1 probably did have a part to play, it just opened to my eyes that actually other people can get kidney disease. So I joined a group on Facebook, and I was expecting everyone on there to have diabetes, but they didn't. And I know this might sound silly, but it was just an eye-opener of, oh, wow. So other people can need kidney transplants and they don't have diabetes. And conversation is always missing. And it goes back to what you took when we just mentioned about the scare tactics, is that it makes you believe, or for me anyway, it made me believe the only people who have problems with their kidneys or anything like everyone who's got diabetes, and actually that's not the case. And people do get sick, but again, sometimes. But I again, going through what I went through, I didn't make that connection.
Do you have any sort of general kidney pointers that might be helpful to people, regardless of whether or not they have diabetes that may be contributing to things? Or what are the main things that they really worry about if they think someone's at risk of developing chronic kidney disease?
So I wouldn't say I don't know if I'm qualified to say that, but what I do know from the whole, when you do get diagnosed with chronic kidney disease, again, maybe it's changed now in terms of but the advice that I was given, which I think could have been developed more, it was more about what they were like, what's your salt intake? And that's the main thing that was drummed into me. And it was about me having to do some research, but then also, yeah, there wasn't as much information that could have been shared. however it might have changed now. But what I would say to anyone is there are specialist organizations out there. So I know in the UK there's obviously Kidney Research UK and Kidney Care. And if you do have any questions, then I would definitely say go to the websites and just do any sort and any research that you can just to be better informed.
Are there anything that people should sort of be keeping an eye on? I know I hear my doctors talk about blood pressure a lot being related to kidneys, and I assume that ties in with the salt restrictions that you've been discussing, worrying about the sodium content of all the things that you eat and stuff. I assume they probably also gave you some medication, some tablets to manage blood pressure as well to try to help keep things in check.
Yes, yeah, they did. See, it's been, and this might sound a bit, but it's been because it's been a while since I was at that place, and I've kind of made peace with it. I've forgotten all of the ins and outs and the numerous tablets that I was taking back then. So yes, yeah, they I did have tablets for my blood pressure, and that's something that was very closely monitored and is still now. But I'm not on tablets for my blood pressure. And so again, I don't know whether this will be relevant to anyone, but I wasn't interested as much back then, but now it's obviously about my EGFR and checking my and just monitoring my kidney function and just seeing how that is doing as well.
So what's life been like after the transplant? I assume you feel a lot better since your body is actually processing waste correctly. Can you sort of give us a little bit of color on that? Is it, was it a sea change almost where, night and day? Or was it a slow progression once you received the transplant and made it through recovery and sort of resumed life?
It was a bit of both. So initially after the operation, I just felt, I just initially felt, and I've spoken to other people who've had a transplant, I felt that I had a second chance at life. And by that, it just felt that, I just had a second chance at life. And there was just a huge difference between how I felt before, and you just have this gratitude for life. And when people talk about transplantation kind of being the gift of life as a transplant recipient, it does feel that way. But then also, like insulin, a transplant isn't a cure, it's just the best treatment. So then there was more of a mental challenge of knowing that at some point your body can and probably will reject the organ. And then it's trying to navigate that and trying to just live life without thinking and waking up every single day, it's going to reject, it's going to reject, it's going to reject. What am I going to do? And that took about 12 to 18 months to overcome. And I had to speak to a renal psychologist about that. And they helped me understand that this was normal for people who had transplants. So then that was another challenge to overcome. But when just having that mindset of it being a second chance of life, it changed a lot for me. And I guess I feel like I'm in a more positive place now than I may not have been, but yeah, it just feels like, yeah, having a second chance of life. And I think, yeah, just organ transplantation is something to when you experience that, it's amazing, kind of just having to go through all of that. So yeah.
I guess sort of a final question for me, regarding the anti-rejection meds that you have to be on post-transplant. Any big issues with those? Any, I mean, that frequently in the context of people who receive islet cell transplants to cure their diabetes, that always gets listed as a major reason that the procedure is not more widely done. So what's that experience been like for you?
Yeah, so just going back to the initial days after the transplant, it was quite intense. It was very difficult because I was on numerous tablets, including steroids, which I'm no longer on any steroids, but that had an impact on managing type 1. I just remember the insulin resistance was sky high. Just trying to get my levels to come down. But gradually over time, as I said, I'm not taking the steroids anymore. So that's not had an impact. I'm on a relatively low dose of immunosuppressants and anti-rejection tablets, which is, from what my consultants have said, is quite rare. So I've not had that many. I wouldn't say I've had like kind of negative experience when it comes to that side of things. I think one kind of side is occasional kind of like acid reflux, but that tends to be it. And also I think a part of it is just remembering to take the immunosuppressants. So I know it might sound again, well, I'm talking to a room of people who have type 1, so I know sometimes you can forget to take insulin. Same, sometimes I can forget to take the tablets. It's not never intentional, but sometimes you're human and you just forget. So there's that side of things. I think just my whole experience with the transplant, I've just been very fortunate that I've had a really good match, and the journey so far hasn't been down as some other people and their journeys when it comes to transplantation. I'm just really fortunate to be able to share parts of this journey like this. But there are probably other people who've had many more challenges than I've experienced.
Well, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to sit down and share your story and share some of the aspects of these things, since it's not something that I would imagine most people, at least hopefully, will experience. But it's an important part of sort of living with diabetes. And so I just want to reiterate, thanks so much for coming on and answering a few questions. And now I'm going to, I guess, turn things back over to Tom.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you for doing that, Chris. Dan, just a question. Do you have regular contact with, I'm not sure who it would be, but consultants or any of the transplant team to monitor how things are going? Or have you kind of gone past that sort of point now? Is there any sort of follow-up points or check-ins or blood tests or anything to see how things are going?
Yes. So in terms of where I am now, I check in with my team roughly every 4 to 6 months, usually on the 6 month side, because when I have the blood tests, if the blood works okay and I'm feeling okay, then they'll have that follow up in every four to six months. But prior to that, initially after the transplantation, I think I was there, I think it might have been 2 or 3 times a week, and then gradually over time it became less and less. But again, it's dependent on the blood work and how I'm feeling. But the team at the hospital that I go to are really great. if I have any questions or anything, I can just send an email and they'll get in contact with me. So with transplantation, it's not just you have the transplant, you go through the initial aftercare and you're forgotten about. No, they do monitor you, and that monitoring always takes place.
Yeah, and has that brought you even closer with your diabetes team in terms of your care? Are they watching you or supporting you even more, or is it just the same?
I would say it's probably the same. So where I had to transplant at a different hospital to where I have my diabetes, where I go for my diabetes care. And so, yeah, I would say it's just the same with my diabetes team.
Yeah, of course.
But but again, when I speak to the nephrologist, we will always touch on type 1 and stuff. So yeah, I don't mix the two as much, purely because they're both at different hospitals.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully, that was just one of the questions I came to mind when I was listening to you and Chris then, and maybe that might have been helpful if anyone else was thinking of that. If anyone has any questions, please hashtag diabetes chat, or you can request to speak. I know, Dan, we've kind of gone over the hour mark, really, but we're coming to the final section. If you're happy to carry on a little bit more, or if you have to jump off, that's totally cool.
Yeah, no, I'm fine to stay on.
Real.
You're as long as I'm tired of hearing my voice.
No, I think everyone's completely fascinated. You know what I mean? It's pure amazing. It's so much emotion, and thank you for coming on and sharing your journeys and perspectives. I think taking everything we've discussed in the last hour or so, moving into our last section, really talking about diabetes advocacy, your peer support, and your podcast. Why is peer support so important, and what's your views on it, and what are the important factors of connecting with others?
When people, as I've mentioned kind of through my experience, when you're in an environment where people just get it, it makes such a huge difference to you. You can just show up as your authentic self. You can be you, and you don't have to worry about it. And also with peer support, there's that opportunity to learn from others. There will be information that I have no idea about that I can learn from somebody via peer support, and it's shared in a way that I can understand as well. I just can't talk highly enough about peer support and just kind of the impact that it's had. Sorry, what was the other part to?
I think you kind of summarized it really, but what are the sort of important factors? What do you take away from peer support? What do people get out of it?
As I've mentioned before, it's that feeling of not being alone, but also connecting with others in the same position as you. So I think that, and there's different mediums that maybe people who don't live with type 1 can or diabetes can connect over, that we as people living with diabetes can also connect over initially, and then diabetes is an add-on. So kind of as of, if you do follow me on any social media, you would have seen that I play futsal with the diabetes football community, and even that part is we're all people who live with type 1. However, football or soccer has brought us, our enjoyment of that game has brought us together. But then the add-on to that is we all live with type 1, and then what happens is we have these kind of these informal off-the-cuff conversations about all areas of type 1. And I've seen from that point there's been questions about insulin pumps and people not knowing how to access an insulin pump, say on the NHS. and going through that process, people maybe knowing how to do that, but then wanting an insulin pump and having being equipped with the information to then go and have that conversation. And there's one of the guys who comes to mind where he's waiting to start on his insulin pump, which has all come about from having the conversations in the group. So yeah. there's that side, there's that side to it. It's kind of a bit informal education, but just
Definitely. It's like, I don't know, if you go to the pub with your mates to watch the football, I know you're a football fan, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's just like going to the pub to watch football. It's a social element, but it's potentially going with a group of people who have diabetes, and connecting with them and having that real experience face to face, or you know what I mean. There are amazing online peer support groups as well, that you can talk and listen and connect with people. So yeah, definitely. Obviously, with your time at JDRF, the amazing things that they were doing, the community engagement team were doing with like the sort of discovery events and stuff like that. Did you get the opportunity to get involved with them sort of things and kind of get out there and see the amazing things they were doing and connecting with people in the community?
So I went to a few events, but as I mentioned, because I work in the HR team, and so it's very disconnected from being out and about in the community. So I didn't go to as many events as, say, somebody who's working within the community engagement team. But when I did go out and was able to meet other people, kind of living with type 1, whether it be adults or just families, it was a good opportunity it's always good to meet with others who are living with type 1 and just listen to people's experiences. I think that there was a long period of time where I was working there where I would never talk about, I didn't talk about type 1 on social media. So because I wasn't talking about it, it was slightly different in comparison to kind of where I am now when it comes to just sharing experiences with living with type 1.
Absolutely. And I think having them opportunities to connect with people in any sort of community event, it's great, isn't it? And sharing experiences. And I know Roz is on the line, and I know you guys presented amazingly at TAD. And then there was opportunity afterwards for people to talk and chat amongst themselves and come over and ask you guys questions and kind of just normalize diabetes. You're in a room with people who know exactly how you feel, go through similar experiences, and they might be able to offer advice. Or when I attended TAD, the first person I spoke to was two parents who their young daughter had diabetes, and it was interesting to hear their perspective and how they sort of support their daughter. So yeah, I think any opportunity anyone gets to go talk to people is incredible. And like Roz, it was just amazing listening to her and her journey of how things have changed so much in the last 30 years. And they were talking about, I remember she was saying about, the cure's coming, five more years. And then you look at today's amazing announcement, Steve Morgan, the 50 million donation, which hopefully will be the next step forward, won't it? So incredible stuff, Dan. What about your podcast then? The Talking Type 1 podcast. What got you into it? What are the reasons behind that?
So when I started my profile on Instagram, just talking more about type 1, and connecting with other people, what I kind of just realized is that there are so many people who I'd spoken to who maybe they don't have huge followings on social media, but their experiences with living with type 1 diabetes, the challenges that they face, the challenges that they've overcome, whether they're living in, and I was able to connect with people in the UK, the US, all over the world. And I was like, there's so much in everyone's journeys, everyone's experiences. You can, why not share what people are going through with others? And so it came from that. I was also a guest on another podcast, a Type 1 podcast, and I really enjoyed that experience. As I said, I work in HR, so I've sat on probably over 1,000 interviews. So I was like, why not bring my HR interview skills and Type 1 and bring that all together, and create a podcast where, for me, it was just about just speaking to just people who live with type 1 and their experiences. Everything every single guest I've spoken to, I've taken something away from the episode. There's so much in everyone's journey with type 1 that I just thought, let's create a platform, let's create something and share their journey, share their experiences. Type 1, okay, fundamentally the condition is the same on paper, but everyone's experience is so different, and that was that's what it was for me, was just creating a platform, speaking to people who live with type 1, and sharing their experiences. And it wasn't about, you have to have so many thousands of followers before I'd even consider speaking to you. It was just, you've got type 1, you've got an interesting journey, let's talk. And that was it. And that will always be the thing for me, is that
it's so powerful, isn't it? Just talking to someone. And if you've got the opportunity to speak to someone about something, you always learn something, and it's just nice to normalize things and just connect with people and feel not alone. And when I've been listening to your podcast, it's just like, you're so relaxed listening to it and just like nodding along going, yeah, I can totally see that in me, in my journey, or that's a good point, and that's something I want to do a bit more research on, or that, you know what I mean? There's so many good things to take away from it. Is there any, because obviously you've got, is it over 40 podcasts? Is there any specific episode or any specific moment that you really enjoyed? I'm sure everyone is unique in its own way. And the same when we've had guest speakers on this, everyone brings something to the table. And is there any moments that you really, wow, that was amazing?
As you quite rightly say, I have taken something away from every single episode. I think one that really kind of sticks or that comes to mind is just two years ago, I did an episode called Black Diabetic and Proud, and I spoke to three other Black people living with type 1, and this was around the time that George Floyd was murdered, and that for me was quite a powerful moment and a powerful episode, and I really enjoyed doing that. Maybe not so much for me, but my most listened to episode is I spoke to somebody, a Priya, and it was just her sharing her journey, her pregnancy journey with type 1, and that's my most listened to episode. And what that showed me was just the need to have these conversations that perhaps aren't, that maybe we don't talk about as much. And I want to have more of these conversations, and so yeah, those two I would say, one personal and maybe one for the community.
Absolutely. And I think even if there's a topic that isn't sort of in focus in what you're going through right now, it might be nice just to listen into it, or there may be a point in your life that it becomes part of your life. So for instance, if you were to become pregnant, then it might be an episode that people might be interested to learn more about, isn't it? And understand people's experiences. So I think the variety of the sort of stories and context is just incredible, and it's just amazing. So where can people go check out all the amazing things you're doing, Dan?
So just to go back to that. So
go for it.
So that I'm planning to hopefully record at some point is just even menopause and living with type 1 diabetes. Again, subject that isn't, from what I observe in the community, is not something that is spoken about. Again, I'm unlikely to experience a menopause, but I feel that, again, if I've got a platform, let's have the conversation. And I've reached out to members of the community already, and so yeah, I just think these conversations are just so important to have. If you want to listen to the podcast, just search for the Talking Type 1 podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you want to connect or follow me, then I'm at T1 Dan on Twitter and Instagram as well.
Brilliant stuff, mate. Just checking out a few of the hashtags that have come through the last hour or so. Mumma Warrior says she's listening to Diabetes Chat. Hannah, ready for the Diabetes Chat tonight. Really looking forward to it. Mary, picking up on what you said before. So, one, acknowledge how you're feeling. Two, reach out. Three, you can overcome where you are, and you have the opportunity to change it. And I think what you said about that was just purely inspiring and amazing. And you know what I mean? It's never too late, and you can always reach out. You can always connect, and you've always got the opportunity to change your perspective or feelings or whatever. You're on your own journey, but you know what I mean? There's a hell of a lot of people behind you who's going to support you along the way.
Definitely. And I guess for me, I just don't want anyone to... I know what it's like when you lose hope and you're living with type 1. And I just don't want anyone to kind of lose hope or just... Yeah. Because it's so easy to do.
Of course. Yeah. 100%. Tim, it's time for the best Twitter hangout of the week. Listening to Dan. Roz, thanks for your honesty and sharing your story, Dan. And then Mary has tweeted again. Dan interviewed me for my JDRF role in January. She said it was the best experience ever and could truly be myself in a job interview. And I think that literally comes across in how you are so calm and how you present. Is, you know what I mean? It's just like talking to a pal, you know what I mean? And that's both on here now and in your podcast and also in real life. When I had the opportunity to meet you, it was just so real and so genuine, and it was just amazing. And you know what I mean? Like Chris said before, you've got so much knowledge, and it's just lovely to connect with you. So thank you, honestly, for coming on this evening. It has been just truly fascinating. I've been really looking forward to it. And last few days when I've been trying to prep some things, I was just like buzzing with excitement. Maybe just to finish, what sort of tips and advice would you maybe give a young child who has diabetes, who's going through their journey now, and maybe a parent who has a child with diabetes, or in fact anyone who's gone through their life with diabetes of any age? What would your sort of final tips or advice be to them?
I guess stuff that I've touched on earlier is that you're doing your own journey, and you're running your own race when it comes to type 1, and your experience is individual to you. Maybe if you're a parent and you've got a child or maybe a teenager who's living with type 1, and you may feel that they're not doing as well as you think they should be doing, just remember that the words that you use carry weight and they carry power. So maybe not, if you are tending to lean on maybe more negative words, just think about the words that you're using and how they come across, and always leave that door open. If you're living with type 1 and maybe you're a teenager if you are in a difficult place at the moment, please do just reach out and get help. And but also know that it's okay to get help, and type 1 is overwhelming as well. And if you are living with complications or you get diagnosed with a complication, just remember that you're not alone and you're not a failure, and don't ever feel like you are either of those two. And it's so easy to feel like that. And I just wanted to say just a thank you, Tom, for the invite. And I know when we met at TAD, as soon as I remember when you said who you were, I did it as soon as it clicked. It was just like, yeah, I really like what you're doing with Diabetes Chat. And yeah, it's really great. And just keep up the great work of creating a platform for people to all come together and share experiences.
Cheers, mate. Honestly, thank you so much. That's so nice to hear that, and your advice and tips. That was just really lovely. You know, we started the chat and we threw them sort of quick round fire questions. And I said, didn't I, do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
Yeah.
I set up a poll, 29 votes currently, and it is swaying. So I put love, hate, and no opinion / not bothered. And it is currently swaying at 43%, no opinion, not bothered. But in terms of love or hate, love is winning. So they're agreeing with you, Dan, that they like the smell of insulin. And Morgan's put mixed. I like it until I smell it coming out from my pump. Mary says, I've been diabetic all my life and I can honestly say I've never ever thought of the smell of insulin. It's just something that I'm used to and need to stay alive. Yeah, absolutely. And my wife, this is just a side joke. It's no like stigmas attached or anything. It's just me and her. When I shoot up to throw some to make sure it's working, she always goes, "Oh, it smells like diabetes in here." But yeah, it's just a nice bit of humor between us. But yeah, you know what I mean. It's everyone has their own opinions and thoughts, isn't it? And yeah, that was just something interesting. And if anyone wants to check that out, it's on the Diabetes Chat page. So just click on that picture and you can go check that out and join in the discussion there. But truly, it's been amazing, Dan. What I want to do quickly, if anyone is interested in coming on and asking a final question to Dan, you're more than welcome to request to speak or quickly fire a hashtag Diabetes Chat. Before we go to Morgan, Chris, Mary, I know you've been on the line. Is there anything you wanted to ask to Dan, or just kind of comment on what Dan said this evening? Maybe we've lost Mary. Possibly. That's the beauty of doing it live, isn't it? Anything can happen. Morgan, Chris, did any sort of final thoughts or... we had a request, but now it's gone. Any sort of final thoughts to the amazing chat with Dan this evening?
I mean, like you said, it was absolutely amazing. Thank you again for coming on. I know you said earlier it was a little strange, like being the one asking being the one asked the questions, but I think you did incredible. And once again, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you. I really do appreciate the invite and just being able to share some aspects of of my journey with type 1. And so yeah, hopefully it's been helpful to at least one person.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I just wanted to echo Morgan's thoughts, say, you know, thank you for coming on and sharing your story. I think that sometimes people ignore complications and sometimes people focus a huge amount of attention on them, and I'm not sure that either extreme is necessarily the correct way to deal with it. But I think that just having you come on and share your experience, and even with in relation to some of the things that may not be completely diabetes related, like your development of the chronic kidney disease, I think it's important for people to hear and understand that not everything is diabetes, and even if it is, it's not always your fault. So again, thank you for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure listening to your answers to Tom's and Morgan's and my questions for the last hour and a half or so.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Chris. And I think what you say about complications, I think that, as I've probably touched on many times, is that it's an important conversation to have, and to just normalize the conversation within the community. And I'm not trying to say, oh, don't worry, living with complications, life is rosy. It's not. It has its challenges. But the more we talk about it as a community, the easier the conversation just becomes. And I just know that no one ever wants to feel alone at that point of being told that you have something which is most likely caused by diabetes, and you just want kind of that safe space to go to and to share what you're going through without any fear, or without any fear of judgment.
Brilliant stuff, Dan. Thank you, honestly, for coming on, mate. And like I said, we've been doing this 12 weeks now, I think. We've had different people, different guest speakers come on from different perspectives, sports athletes, advocates, healthcare professionals, people living with type 1 diabetes. And obviously, and today, like, looking at sort of like the complications and that, it's very insightful. And people obviously living these sort of things or have these things in their mind from when they're first diagnosed or throughout their journey. So honestly, pure inspiration coming on tonight and chatting. I hope you have a great evening, mate, and we'll obviously keep in touch and keep working together.
Yeah, definitely. And just thank you again for inviting me on. I do appreciate it.
Cheers, mate.
Really, just keep up the great work.
You know, it just feels like we're just like in the pub, just having a chat, and there's like, 34 people currently listening. It just feels like we're just in the pub and we're just listening to you, and we've just got a few pints, or we know what I mean. There's Janina over there, and she's just got some food and she's carving her food, and we're all enjoying listening into you. And you know what I mean? It just feels so special. Like, we're all just like listening in and getting on with our busy lives, but it honestly just feels like we're talking to friends. And I think that's the beauty of the diabetes community, isn't it? That's what makes it so special. And to me, that's my perspective of it. I just feel like I'm just talking to you guys just in a pub. That's how magical it is.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
Nice one, mate. Cheers, buddy.